I'm Brad Beenow. This is the Theology of Baseball. And on my lap here is my son, Martin, who's agreed to help me sing a song for you. Okay? Are you ready to do it? Let's do it. Okay? This is a song called Cooperstown, written by Terry Cashman. Okay? Do you know how it goes? How I hugged my daddy when he gave me that old baseball glove. I think I slept with it that night. I loved it so much. I wonder if
Hank Aaron
started out that way, dreaming of the big leagues and the Hall of Fame. I'm going to the place where baseball lives. Ruth and Cobb and
Joe DiMaggio.
Do 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 do. Sunny days and Willie Mays. You'll be glad you took the trip to Cooperstown, the town where baseball lives. A ball and a bat and some kids in an empty lot. You know we stayed out late till Mama said, hey, hurry home, it's getting dark. I read about the train and Rogers Hornsby. They're part of America and they're part of me. I'm going to the place where baseball lives. Ruth and Cobb and
Joe DiMaggio.
Do 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 do. Sunny days and Willie Mays. You'll be glad you took the trip to Cooperstown, the town where baseball lives. Thank you. Okay. Thanks a lot. Okay. You can go sit with your mom. You want to sit with me? Okay. Let's see how long this lasts. As I said, I'm Brad Beenow, and I'm a member of the Society for American Baseball Research. It truly exists. I also coach the Trinity Seminary softball team, and sort of in my part-time, then I teach pastoral theology around the cracks and the corners. This is the Theology of Baseball. You know what, Martin? I am going to let you sit with your mom, because Walt and I have to do something together here. That's okay. Yeah, I'll take you back in a minute, if you don't mind. We want to share... we're going to do this first to get ourselves going. There's a reason why also, and Martin will be back. I'll talk to you about the Cooperstown song there in a minute. But before we get into that, a true baseball classic, which when I was at Cooperstown a couple years ago, this was on the video monitor in the museum. Abbott and Costello, who's on first? Okay, so Walt has graciously agreed to do this with me. We did not try to commit it to memory, but so be it. Now I kind of forget who's doing who. You're doing Abbott, I think.
I'm doing Abbott.
That's right, okay.
So, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, here we go. Well, Costello, I'm going to New York with you. You know Bucky Harris, the Yankees manager, gave me a job as coach for as long as you're on the team.
Look, Abbott, if you're the coach, you must know all the players.
I certainly do.
You know, I never met the guys, so you'll have to tell me their names, and then I'll know who's playing on the team.
Oh, I'll tell you their names. But you know, strange as it may seem, they give these ballplayers nowadays very peculiar names.
You mean funny names?
Strange names, pep names like Dizzy Dean and his...
And his brother Daffy?
And Daffy Dean.
And their French cousin?
French.
Gouffet Dean.
Gouffet Dean. Oh, I see. Oh, now let's see. We have on the bags, we have who's on first, what's on second, I don't know, is on third.
That's what I want to find out.
I say who's on first... What's on second? I don't know who's on third.
Are you the manager?
Yes.
You're going to be the coach, too?
Yes.
You know the fella's names?
Well, I should.
Well, then who's on first?
Yes.
I mean the fella's name.
Who?
The guy on first.
Who?
The first baseman.
Who?
The guy playing first.
Who is on first?
I'm asking you who's on first.
That's the man's name.
That's whose name?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
That's it.
That's who?
Yes.
Look, you got a first baseman?
Certainly.
Well, who's playing first?
That's right.
When you pay off the first baseman every month, who gets the money?
Every dollar of it.
All I'm trying to find out is the fellow's name on first base.
Who?
The guy that gets the money.
That's it.
Who gets the money?
He does every dollar of it. Sometimes his wife comes down and collects it.
Whose wife?
Yes. What's wrong with that?
Look, all I want to know is, when you sign up the first baseman, how does he sign his name to the contract?
Who?
The guy.
Yeah, who?
How does he sign his name?
That's how he signs his name.
Who?
Yes.
I'm trying to find out is what's the guy's name on first base?
No, what's on second
base? I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
One base at a time.
Well, don't change the play.
I'm not changing nobody.
Take it easy, buddy.
All I'm asking you. Who's the guy on first base?
That's right.
Okay.
All right.
What's the guy's name on third base?
No, what is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
Oh, he's on third. But we're not talking about that. Now let's get
now,
back.
Now, how did I get on third base?
Well, you mentioned his name.
If I mentioned the third baseman's name, who did I say is playing third?
No, who's playing first?
What's on first?
What's on second?
I don't know.
He's on third.
There I go, back on third again. Look, will you stay on third base and don't go off it?
All right. Now, what do you want to know?
Now, who's playing third base?
Why do you insist on putting who on third base?
What am I putting on third?
What's on second?
You don't want what? You don't want who on second?
Who is on first?
I don't know. Third base.
Third base.
Look, you got an outfield?
Yes.
The left fielder's name.
Why?
I just thought I'd ask you.
Well, I just thought I'd tell you.
Then tell me who's playing left field.
Who is playing first?
I'm not. Stay out of the infield. I want to know what's the guy's name in left field.
No, what is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
Third base.
And the left fielder's name.
Why?
Because.
Oh, he's in center field. You know the players as well as I do.
You got a pitcher on the team?
Sure.
The pitcher's name?
Tomorrow.
You don't want to tell me today?
I'm telling you now.
Then go ahead.
Tomorrow.
What time?
What time what?
What time tomorrow you're going to tell me who's pitching?
No, now listen, who is not pitching?
I'll break your arm, you say, who's on first. I want to know what's the pitcher's name.
What's on second?
I don't know.
Third base.
You got a catcher?
Certainly.
The catcher's name?
Today.
Today. And tomorrow's pitching?
Now you got it.
All we got's a couple of days on our team. You know, I'm a catcher, too.
So they tell me.
Okay, I get behind the plate. I do some fancy catching. Tomorrow's pitching on my team, and a heavy hitter gets up.
Yes.
Now, the heavy hitter bunts the ball. Now, when he bunts the ball, me being a good catcher, I'm going to throw the guy out at first base, so I pick up the ball and throw it to who?
Now, that's the first thing you've said right all year.
I don't even know what I'm talking about.
That's all you have to do.
Is to throw the ball to first base.
Yes.
Now, who's got it?
Naturally.
Look, if I throw the ball to first base, somebody's got to get it. Now, who has it?
Naturally.
Who?
Naturally.
Naturally?
Naturally.
So I pick up the ball and I throw it to naturally.
No, you don't. You throw the ball to who?
Naturally.
That's different.
That's what I said.
You're not saying that.
I throw the ball to naturally.
No, you throw it to who?
Naturally.
That's it.
That's what I said.
You ask me.
All right, I throw the ball to who?
Naturally.
Now you ask me.
You throw the ball to who?
Naturally.
That's it.
Same as you!
Don't change them around.
Same as you!
Go ahead, now get it over with.
All right. I throw the ball to who? Whoever it is drops the ball, the guy runs to second. Who picks up the ball and throws it to what? What throws it to I don't know. I don't know throws it back to tomorrow. Triple play.
Yes.
Another guy gets up and hits a long fly ball to because. Why? I don't know. He's on third and I don't give a darn.
What?
I said I don't give a darn.
Oh, that's our shortstop.
It never fails. It doesn't fail.
Well, Michael Kovler reminded me earlier of a great Yogi Berra quote, which is that 90% baseball is 90% half mental. So that's what we're here to do. It reminds me of another Yogi Berra-ism. The other day, I don't know if I told you this, I was going through the lunch line, and I had on my Trinity Seminary sweatshirt and my Trinity Seminary hat, and one of the kitchen workers came out and said to me, "This may be a silly question, but do you know Walt Bowman?" Which, and we share certain things. But that reminds me that when Yogi Berra's son Dale came up to the big leagues, he played for the Pirates for a little while and then for the Yankees, some reporter asked him whether he had the same facility with the English language that his father had, who was, famous for butchering everything up. And Dale said, no, I don't. His similarities and mine are a lot different. His similarities and mine are a lot different.
Mickey Mantle once said to him, "What time is it?" And Yogi replied, "You mean right now?"
And after he played a few games at the old Comiskey Park in Chicago, they said, "Yogi, how do you like playing there in the night games?" He says, "Nobody likes to play at Comiskey. It gets late real early." And then they asked him if he wanted to go out to this restaurant called Charlie's after the game, and Yogi said, "Nobody goes to Charlie's anymore. It's always too crowded." Okay.
How are we going to get to the theology?
I'm killing time here. What I decided to do was I came up with 10 things that I'm prepared to say something theological about, but you may have others. So I put them up here on the diamond, sort of, and with no particular reason for anybody playing any position, except the owners are off here on the side where they belong. We can pick and choose. But I want to start at least with the one in the middle on the pitcher's mound to give you some thinking going, and why I had Martin come up and sing this song with me. And my theological mentor here will correct me on the medieval history of all this. Anselm of Canterbury was the one who, in Latin, said, "Fides quaerens intellectum," translated as faith-seeking understanding, that this is the kind of soul of the theological enterprise, that you don't think your way into the Christian faith, but you are rather gifted with faith, which then turns into a lifelong task of trying to find ways to articulate and understand the meaning of the faith that you've been given. These people that I hang out with sometimes in the Society for American Baseball Research, I think are a good example of what this means. Somewhere along the line, we got gifted with a certain kind of commitment to baseball, a faith in the enterprise. And when you've got that, you suddenly get interested in understanding the nuances and the intricacies and the fine points and the history and, maybe even the theology of what all this means. I have yet to meet the person who understands their way into the faith of baseball. It's a sort of thing that you either get it given to you or you don't. Our dear seminary president, Dr. Dennis Anderson, who may make a great bishop of the church, but he'll never be commissioner of baseball. Well, maybe nobody will ever be commissioner of baseball. He's a person who just fundamentally doesn't get it and is happy to say so. Does not understand baseball, does not understand why anybody would like baseball, that's it. It's just not one of his things. And there are people like that. I assume pretty much everybody here has some passion about this, or you wouldn't be here. I'm probably being more successful at this stage of Martin's life gifting him with baseball than I am with Christianity. I mean, he's more able to understand it. Although he can sing "One in the Spirit" and "Jesus Loves Me" about as well as he can sing that song about Cooperstown. But when I first heard that song, Terry Cashman's song, that really resonated because he wrote it, in fact, because his son, after they went to Cooperstown, his son said, I want to go back, Dad, to the place where baseball lives. And if you've ever been to Cooperstown, you know what that's like. And if you haven't, you just need to make sure before you die, you go. You get gifted with this, you know. Your dad or somebody takes you to a baseball game or gives you that first baseball glove and teaches you how to read box scores and line scores and keep score and listen on the radio and you know, it gets in your blood. And then eventually you start hanging out with people who like to read the baseball encyclopedia and things like that, and you work your way into it. I think theology is a lot the same way. You know, if you get taken to church and you get taught some things and you hang around people who are interested, and a gift can really change your life, you know. Sooner or later you get interested in some of the intricacies of what it all means. You know, what is baptism and what is Eucharist and who are these people in the history of the whole enterprise and how did they play the game, really, you know, theologically? What did they bring to the field? What were their gifts? How did they work off each other? All that sort of thing. So I start with that premise that this is faith seeking understanding. Everybody here has probably got some faith in this, and what we're trying to do is just understand better what it means. Therefore, I don't, you know, it's 90% half mental, so we're just going to talk our way through it. Some topic up here, you know, this, I started to feel like I was writing Jeopardy topics, you know, I'll take things serving people for 100 or whatever. If any of that intrigues you, I'll share some thoughts and we can go with that, or if there's any other thing where you see some connection, we can try that. I have two things I did not put up here that I've toyed around with, and if you have thoughts on these, then we can go somewhere too. I've been trying to think my way into the filioque clause and the labor management dispute in baseball along the lines of, from whence proceeds the spirit of baseball? You know, the filioque clause is the business about whether the spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son, or just the Father, or Father through the Son, or whatever. But I haven't been able to figure that out, so I didn't put that up here. And the other is the designated hitter and substitutionary theories of the atonement, which I thought I once had sort of figured out, but then that, I don't know, I couldn't hold it together. So we can talk about any of that. We're really here just to talk about the things in baseball that fascinate us, and I think anything that has a deep fascination is going to get theological. Because baseball is a kind of religion with a small r. So, it's open, and see where you want to go with it.
Well, right away I was interested, why home plate, not fourth base? Because I have a grandson that asked me that.
Oh, sharp kid.
And my only answer for him was, well, you start out at home and you end up at home.
You got it. And it's the only place on the whole baseball field, the only place where you're not permitted to stand. You can touch it, you can cross it, but you can't stand there. In fact, if you stand there when you're hitting, they throw you out. I mean, you're out, you have to leave. You can't come home and stand there. You touch home and go back and sit down and wait for your next turn. Bart Giamatti, who's a former commissioner of baseball and former president of Yale University, among other things, died in 1989, has a book called Take Time for Paradise, which is really an interesting read. It was a series of three lectures that he did at the University of Michigan on something like leisure and sport in American life, or something like this. And his third essay is about baseball as narrative. And he's extremely eloquent, and if I knew that I was going to be doing this when I came up here, I should have brought this with me, but you'll get the synopsis rather than the direct quote. He talks about baseball as a narrative of the human journey and what it means. Just as you said, it all starts at home, just like we all started someplace we called home. And the point is to to take your journey and make it safely home again without, you know, as they say, dying at second. You know, you get cut down by some evil shortstop or something. But the point is, if you're lucky enough to do that, and sometimes you are, you know, other people sacrifice for you, right, and help you along sometimes, and you make it home. If you're lucky enough to do that, then he says the bat is like an oar over your shoulder. All you can do is pick it up and begin the journey again. I mean, he's very Homeric about this. It's like the Odyssey. But there's truth in that. I mean, that really is the fundamental part of the Christian story, that the joy is in the journey and not necessarily in the destination. I mean, as Walt was saying in his session yesterday about the resurrection, we know how it's all going to come out. I mean, that's the done deal. The interesting part is how you get from here to there. It's the excitement and the knowledge that if you don't make it this time, you're going to get to bat again and try again. Giamatti also says that the really important part of the focus of home is that just like in real life, real domestic life, the both reconciliation and confrontation are most likely to occur at home. This is where everybody comes to gather around you if you hit a home run and it's a happy moment and all that. But it's the one place on the baseball field where you most consistently expect you're going to have violent confrontation. I mean, the classic episode of Pete Rose and in the 1970 All-Star game with Ray Fosse, you know, just that sort of made Pete Rose's career and just set up an image in our minds.
Or Enos Slaughter stealing home base in the final game of the World Series with a winning run, 1946.
Yep, right? Yep, yep. Enos Country Slaughter, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So home becomes the real focal point, even with the kind of father umpire there to preside over almost rival siblings, you know, and sort the whole thing out. It does work. So it's the one uneven sort of thing on the baseball field. Everything else is wonderfully symmetrical, circles and squares, straight line, and then you got this weird pentagon type thing. I mean, it's a five-sided trapezoidal, I don't know what you call it. But it's the focal point because it's unique and odd, and I think much of what we come to assume is going to happen at home in domestic life and Christian life really is kind of modeled on the baseball field. I don't know. Home may evoke other things for all of you, but there's nothing that quite tugs at you like home, and you know the thought of making it home in baseball is what it's all about. Everything, Giamatti says, it baseball proves to us how desperate and driven our need is to get home. I mean, everything in baseball is geared from on the one hand to get home, and on the other hand to prevent somebody from getting home. But home is really what it's all about. And so, you know, if heaven is home, you know, that may be a happy thought for some and a not very happy thought for others. I don't know. But in the best sense of what home means, that's the reign of God, you know, drawing us all, pulling us all along somehow.
Why is it a Lutheran sport?
Ah.
As far away from home as you can get.
Yeah. Well, I think that baseball is wonderfully oriented around law and gospel. And so it's therefore not a Catholic or a Reformed sport. It's wonderfully Lutheran. I mean, if you think about it, on the one hand, well, George Will in various writing, I don't agree with George Will on much of anything, but he's pretty good on baseball. In his book Men at Work, he talks about how baseball is a pure and true what he calls meritocracy. You absolutely succeed or fail on the basis of your own merit. There is no favoritism at a major league level anyway. People are ruthlessly traded and demoted or elevated, all depending on their performance. And, you know, I mean, just think about how it would be to live under this excruciating sort of centerpiece or just the constant focus of the law on you, to have your job performance every morning in the newspaper scrutinized to the third decimal point. You know, think about that. And the whole country knows how you're doing in your batting average, in your fielding percentage, in your ERA. You know, to the second, third, sometimes even fourth decimal point. You know, Ted Williams wins the batting crown one year. They have to go to four decimal places to figure out down to the last at bat.
How about the guy who's 0-36?
Yeah. Or I remember Stan Bonson, one of my favorites when I was a kid, growing up with the Cleveland Indians. This was before the designated hitter. Stan Bonson couldn't hit a lick. And when they interviewed him one time, he said, "When was the last time you got a hit?" And he said, "Oh, I'm 0 for several years." Yeah. You know, you have to put up with the scrutiny. And that's the experience of the law. You know, always being examined, always having to measure your worth in terms of your performance and so forth. But balancing that, on the other hand, is the wonderful graciousness of baseball. That you know in a cycle of a game, you're going to get a couple of chances. You know, you're going to get to bat at least three or four times. The pitcher is going to get to face at least 27 hitters, and, you know, more if he gives up a lot of hits and runs. There's always the possibility, well, you can foul off the ball any number of times you want, you know, and you can keep trying, you can keep hanging in there with it. And then there's always the possibility of extra innings. And best of all, the most gracious thing, I think, is there's no clock. Mm-hmm. Baseball is the one sport that theoretically can go on forever. I mean, now they're introducing these crazy, you know, we want so many seconds till the pitcher pitches the ball and all that kind of nonsense. It's the one game free from time constraints. And that's, I think that's part of its appeal to some nostalgic part of an American rural past. We want to believe that it was, you know, a slower, easier time, which is really silly because baseball essentially grew up in the city, not in some cow pasture in Cooperstown, whatever the Abner Doubleday myth is about that. It really was probably invented in Hoboken, New Jersey, in a city. It was really a city game. But there's this gracious side that isn't constrained. And so you have a wonderful balance of scrutiny and leisure, you know, that kind of come together. I don't know. You maybe somebody else can think of other things that communicate law and gospel, but or if I thought of anything else that I forgot, no, I guess that's about it.
Why did you put the owners outside?
I'd put them over here if I could. Well, it has struck me that the whole, somebody said, you know, they were hoping we didn't get into the labor management thing. I wondered how long we'd be before we got to that.
Oh, I'll withdraw the question.
No. It's fundamentally important. It's very theological. I think the basic problems that baseball is having today have to do with a lack of theological insight about stewardship. Why do these people consider themselves the owners of the game? I mean, who can own baseball? But these, well, if you've read this book, Lords of the Realm by John Hellier, published about a year and a half ago, brilliant book. He's a writer for the Wall Street Journal and researched, it's the history of baseball from a labor management perspective. And it's very insightful in these times. He points out how the fundamental pig-headedness of the people who have owned baseball teams, we're really not into anything new. This is just the latest manifestation of something that's gone on since forever. They do not understand that they are stewards of something larger than themselves. And so this is the classic example of human unoriginal sin, confusing creature and creator, wanting to assume control of things that are not ours to control but are ours to manage, to be stewards of, and to take care of, have dominion over in the sense of caretaking, but not dominion in the sense of domination. We've gotten to a point where all the spirit of baseball has all but been squashed out of it by people who want to regulate, control, wring every last economic dollar And again, it's a fundamental stewardship point. We've had sessions here this week about family and money and so forth. You know, which mindset here? The enoughness mindset that Tim has talked about, the mindset of abundance, or the mindset of scarcity? And right now what we've got is the mindset of scarcity. There's not enough to go around. You know, the owners say, we're not giving you one more nickel than we can get away with, and the players say, we want all we can get. Personally, I think they're completely justified. The point is, there's plenty of money to go around if they are good stewards of this game. People will pay to come and see it. The networks will fork over gazillions of dollars to televise this, as long as they take good care of it. And when they're poor stewards, then, of course, the money does drop off, and we see that kind of sinful, self-centered cycle setting in. And then the question is there enough? You know. And, well, the point in life is, as Tim has said, the enoughness of God. There is enough. There's enough baseball and enough money and enough opportunities for everybody to have some and be happy. But we put up with a history of incredibly cheap people. In Hellier's book, he makes the comment about Calvin Griffith, who is the former owner of the Minnesota Twins, if any of you remember him. Somebody said swimming was first invented when Calvin Griffith drove up to the first toll bridge. Okay, so, I mean, that's sort of the history of baseball management. And it goes all the way back to 1919 and the so-called Black Sox scandal. Charlie Comiskey, who was the owner of the White Sox, was just absolutely notoriously cheap, stingy, mean, selfish. And these nine players on the White Sox that year in the World Series against the Reds saw it as their one chance to recoup the money that they rightfully should have been paid all that time, to throw the series and then bat accordingly.
Great movie on that, 8 Men Out.
It was 8, not 9, sorry. And of course popularized by Field of Dreams and the Shoeless Joe Jackson saga and so forth. Who, as they say in that movie, I mean, he hit over 300 in the series. How could he have been trying to throw it? But if you understand where management was coming from in that era, that's the only... I mean, players didn't have a union. Now they just sue them and take them to court, and they win every time. We haven't yet to see a time when the players don't win when they go to court. It's just amazing that the owners don't get it, but so far it appears to me they haven't. That's another law aspect of baseball. We litigate everything and go to court.
Just the thrill of the grass.
This is the mystic side of baseball. W. Kinsella, who wrote the book Shoeless Joe that became the movie Field of Dreams, has written a number of things on baseball, which I really like. One is called The Iowa Baseball Confederacy, but there's another collection of short stories that he's got called The Thrill of the Grass. There's a great short story there, by the way, called Why Thurman Munson Died for Your Sins. I won't try to get into why that is, but he was killed in a plane crash in 1979, catcher for the Yankees. He talks about, The Thrill of the Grass is a story about the baseball strike in the season of 1981, which up till last year was the longest strike, killed baseball for about a month and a half, the middle of the 1981 season. And he's got a kind of fanciful story about a group of guys who, in the midst of the strike, go to their local big league park that has AstroTurf, an AstroTurf field, and surreptitiously every night under the cover of darkness, they go and they start carving up the AstroTurf and planting grass seed. And when the strike is over, they come back and open the ballpark and they've got real grass again to play on. But his comment is, and he says this again in the Shoeless Joe book, that, and I think it's even, he has Shoeless Joe say this about you know, to be exiled is so terrible. I'll never again have this sense of the thrill of the grass. I think every one of us can probably remember the first time you went to a major league baseball stadium. I mean, I will never forget Cleveland Municipal Stadium, 1965. They don't build stadiums this way either, unfortunately, where the tunnel comes up from underneath, you know. Now that we build stadiums without posts and supports, you don't enter the field that way. You come down from the top. But when you could come up the tunnel, and the first thing you saw was this expanse of grass. I mean, I think that's a kind of religious feeling. It's something like the first time you hear the Mass sung or the liturgy sung or something, you know, First Communion, I don't know. There's a thrill that keeps you, that hooks you and keeps you coming back. And it has something very much to do with I think the greenness of grass. Giamatti talks about it as the garden, the enclosed green space. That's the definition of paradise. Literal definition of paradise is an enclosed green space, an enclosed kind of garden. You know, all the business about baseball having rural, pastoral origins really kind of misses the point. The point is, it's really the grass in the ghetto, in a sense. It's all the grass you're going to find in the Bronx, basically, at Yankee Stadium, unless they move to Jersey or something. There's a kind of thrill of the naturalness of the grass of it all in the midst of a very hustling, bustling city. That's a kind of wonderful thing that I think just engages you and keeps you coming back. We'd all have to sort out for ourselves what the theological, religious equivalent of that is that keeps us engaged in the faith. But I think, you know, well, if it weren't for that, why didn't they paint AstroTurf yellow or something, you know? I mean, they had to keep it green because there's just a sense about it. And finally, they're even, St. Louis is about to get rid of their artificial turf and go back to grass.
It's interesting, bless them. Yeah, how they're all moving back to grass.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
But grass is harder to maintain, harder to keep dry.
But over the long haul, your players stay a lot healthier.
Yeah, that's the pitch.
And that's the trade-off, you know. Do you want something you can just suck the water off of, or something that'll let your star player play 3 years longer? Tony Gwynn would be out of baseball now if he were playing in Philadelphia or St. Louis. I mean, he's got terrible knees and he's overweight, but he's still hitting .357 because he's played his whole career in San Diego on a good grass field. And that's the difference. So there's a, you know, there's kind of a trade-off there. But you don't like the designated hitter either, so I assume you would be against artificial turf.
I am against artificial turf.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't like the designated hitter.
I know.
Okay.
Let's talk about the designated hitter.
Yeah, well, if you can make it theological, all the better, but even if you can't, go ahead. You explain why you don't like the designated hitter. And if there's any theology to that, then let us know that too.
I grew up in western Minnesota in the 40s, 30s and 40s, when the only baseball team that broadcast there were the St. Louis Cardinals. And so I became a Cardinal fan from the time I was able to listen to the radio. And in 1952, I interned in New York City, and the Cardinals had great hitters, Musial, Shane Dienst, Whitey Karofsky, and Terry Moore and all these people. But they came to Brooklyn and to the Giants and to Brooklyn to play while I was in New York and faced these murderous lineups, Duke Snyder and Roy Campanella and all these people. And I always hoped for the pitcher, you know, who would come up to hit and give you a little bit of breathing space in these dreadful lineups. And so you had to take your chances with the long line of hitters, but you always had that breathing space. Possibly the eighth batter wouldn't be all that good, but the pitcher you could surely get out, and you could relax a little bit and gather your strength for the leadoff man. And so I think that that the game needs that kind of relaxation. I could always go and get a gin and tonic when the pitcher was up to bat. You know, nothing bad was going to happen.
Fastest bartender in the world.
Except that once in a while you'd get a pitcher who could hit too, like Gibson. Bob Gibson, who often would pitch these wonderful games for the Cardinals and win them with a timely hit, or, I mean, he was capable of hitting home runs. He was the complete player. He was the star pitcher, and at the same time was a formidable opponent at bat. And it seems to me that the game calls for that kind of thing. Brad and I have argued over whether it takes more managerial skill to work with the pitcher having to bat. I'm not convinced by Brad's arguments. I'll let him make them in a minute here. But I keep thinking you get a better game, and you require more managing skills if the pitcher has to hit for himself.
This shows your fundamental law orientation, which we'll get to. But comment back here first.
Yeah, I also don't believe that those being hitter, but
he's using religious language. Did you hear that? He what? Doesn't believe in the designated hitter.
Great. Yes. There we go.
Well, I think that everyone has strengths and weaknesses, and part of playing a game is learning to develop your weaknesses, and I think that's part of life too. You have strengths and weaknesses, and when you recognize your weaknesses, you develop them. And by allowing someone who has a weakness in hitting to not have to do that, then you are taking away from the game, because you're taking away from that aspect of the game, which is an aspect of life.
Yeah,
great point.
Yeah. An insufficient one, but a great point.
All right.
I can't believe I'm sitting up here defending the designated hitter. but here's the point. This is good theology too. We will not allow mere sentiment to prevail here. No fuzzy-headed thinking. You've got to build a more solid case for why this is not a good idea. And there are at least a couple of good points that can be made to refute this. One is your fundamental law orientation about this. What you really want to do is see the pitchers suffer and have their weaknesses exposed, and everybody should get their just desserts. I think that's what drives a lot of thinking about the designated hitter. People just say fair is fair, and nobody should get off the hook.
Unless the right team's up to bat.
Yeah, well.
but
your point is well taken. You should be pressed to develop your weaknesses, but then you have to answer the question of why do we allow relief pitchers? If you want to make an argument against a designated hitter, you got to be the same person then who says no relief pitchers. This guy's got to go all 9 innings, no matter how badly he's getting shelled, no matter how tired he gets, if he can't stand the heat and stay out of the pitcher's mound or whatever. But baseball has always accepted the premise that you could substitute people of greater skill at a time in the game when their particular skill was needed. We've always had defensive replacements at various positions. We've always allowed relief pitching, even though that's become much more of an art and a specialty, but you've always been able to do it. So it follows with complete baseball logic that the designated hitter should be an option. You should not force people to do things that they can't do.
It's not the same thing. When you bring in a relief pitcher, the regular pitcher can't go back into the game again, but you bring in a designated hitter and the pitcher can go on pitching. It's not like substituting for somebody. You take your chances when you substitute. You don't take any chances with the designated hitter.
Well, back to the managerial question then, which is, the argument is always made, well, you got to handle your pitchers better in the National League because you don't have any, you got to strategically determine when to hit for them. That's nonsense. The real strategy of managing pitchers is when you don't get to hit for them. National League manager, you think about it, who are the great managers in the National League? There aren't that many. The great managers are in the American League right now with guys like Sparky Anderson and Tony La Russa. Because the strategy in the American League is the game never dictates when the pitcher has to come out. You don't get the luxury of saying, well, I had to pinch hit for him because we were 2 runs behind. In the American League, you have to know your pitcher, and you have to make a strategic decision about exactly when that pitcher's out of gas. The National League people basically get off the hook because they say, well, you know, what else could I do? I had to hit for him. I think that takes less baseball savvy than it does to deal with a designated hitter.
How does the argument for all the arguments for designated hitter differ in kind and keep you fundamentally from not finally advocating a two-platoon system in baseball? I mean, because maybe not only the pitcher is a weak hitter, but maybe your shortstop is a weak hitter. So let's have the shortstop continue because he's a good infielder, shortstop. Not a good hitter, let's have a designated hitter for him. Okay. And pretty soon you got maybe three good sluggers, and they can, four. And you know, two platoon baseball.
Here's the answer.
Well, platooning has been going on big time for at least 30 years. One of the great platoon managers was Casey Stengel. Stengel was one of the biggest platoon managers, and then Weaver picked it up, and some of the greatest teams in baseball. With the possible exception of the Big Red Machine. They did a little bit platooning, but not to the extent that those other teams did. That's already in the mix, and it's been in the mix from day one. So at least in terms of the modern era.
And I think, I think your point is basically really well taken. That's where the whole thing starts to break down. However, I would still say, here you are, a legalist and a purist. You're going to say, I want it all one way, or I want it all the other. We either have nobody doing this, or we're going to have everybody doing it. You know, we'll have just an offense and a defense. And I say, why can't we be a little flexible and gracious? Let's have, you know, a little bit of it. Be kind to those who can't hit. I mean,
somebody's got to keep up the Mendoza line.
Right. You all know what that is? Mendoza was a guy who barely hit 200 in his lifetime. So if you're not hitting over 200, you're not over the Mendoza line. The point with pitchers are that simply it's not really their fault that they can't hit. I mean, they only get to play the game every fourth or fifth day, if that. And it's very hitting a baseball. Has anybody ever actually stood in a batting cage and tried to hit a ball at 80, 90 miles an hour?
Murder.
I mean, it's by you before you can even see it.
Most difficult feat in sport.
The most difficult feat in baseball is not hitting a 90 mile an hour fastball. It's hitting the changeup at 75 miles an hour that comes after the 90 mile.
Swing twice.
You don't see that many people strike out on the fastball. You see them strike out on a very slow pitch after they're ready to hit a fastball.
What makes Randy Johnson so deadly right
yeah,
now.
Yeah. He can throw at either speed. And so the point for the pitchers are that, you know, when you only get to bat a couple of times every fourth or fifth day, you don't get what baseball players call muscle memory, you know, conditioned, where you literally, you know, your muscles, you don't have time to think, you just react. And you can't stop yourself from swinging at a bad pitch, even though you know it's not you've already committed. So you know why do we feel this insistence on punishing pitchers? It's not their fault they can't hit. Whatever. That has something to do with substitutionary
atonement.
Oh, well, okay. Tell me.
I want to get to the foul lines, though.
Oh,
that's
okay.
One of your most interesting points.
Okay, yeah, and I got a quote for you on that here somewhere. What did I do with those? From
you'd have a quote dealing with fouls and me.
Right.
Foul balls and me.
There you go. This is from Kinsella's book, The Iowa Baseball Confederacy. And he's talking to his father about, or the father of the main character anyway, about the meaning of baseball. Why not baseball, my father would say. Name me a more perfect game. Take the layout. No mere mortal could have dreamed up the dimensions of the baseball field. No man could be, or woman, could be that perfect. Abner Doubleday, if he did indeed invent the game, must have received divine guidance. And the field runs to infinity, he would shout, gesturing wildly. Did you ever think of that? There's no limit to how far a person might possibly hit a ball. And there's no limit to how far a fleet outfielder might run to retrieve it. The foul lines run on forever, forever diverging. There's no place in America that's not part of a ball field. The meanest ghetto, the highest point of land, the Great Lakes, the Colorado River. Hell, there's no place in the world that's not part of a baseball field. Every other sport is held by boundaries, but there's no limit to the size of a baseball field. And the, you know, the outfield fence was just a concession to having to build modern ballparks and so forth. But when baseball was first invented, you know, spectators would sometimes line, you know, somewhere, or even sit and have picnic lunches out there in the outfield. But if the ball got hit into them, the fielder simply had to retrieve it. Well, it strikes me, I mean, just in a very visual sort of way, that foul lines diverging are very cross-like. But isn't this theologically what we're also saying about the cross? That, I mean, the arms of the cross diverge, and there is no place in the universe that is not covered by what that represents. I mean, it spreads out so that all is encompassed. There is no place that is not God's place. You know, the whole world is part of the baseball field. Well, the whole world is God's playing field. If you have a cross at the center and what that means, it just spreads out and goes on forever. Anyway, that's what I think that's all about. It's kind of fun to imagine.
Yeah. I'd be interested if I saw it on the radio.
Oh. Well, yeah, Walt was sort of talking about that before, you know, what was that, the 52 World Series or whatever?
The 52 season.
Oh, the season when you were there.
53 season.
Yeah, they weren't in the World Series in 52, were they?
No, but that's when I was in New York, and that's when the Cardinals came. They always played two series, one with Brooklyn and one with the Giants.
And then, okay.
The Supreme World Series was 46 when the Cardinals beat the Red Sox in seven games, and Slaughter stole home with a winning run in the ninth inning, and oh my. But seeing it on the radio is the name of the game. Right. One of the things that bothers me is to have visualized what I would much rather imagine. Mm-hmm. And I could sit by the radio and imagine what was going on the ball field. I didn't see my first big league ball game until 1949 when I was in Detroit. And it was exciting, but not as exciting as watching it on radio. And I'm not sure that things have improved that much by having television zero in on everything. And I like to listen. I just love to listen. I sit in my study and I work away and there's the game. And I'm imagining everything that's going on, and it's a lot better than when you see it.
You can't capture the spitting of tobacco juice on the radio quite as well as you can on TV, but other than that, this phrase that I saw it on the radio is the title of another Terry Cashman song. And it's a really nice song. He's got woven into it some play-by-play by Red Barber and Bob Prince and some of the great classics, Mel Allen and Vin Scully and so forth. But he's got a line in the song that goes, turn it up louder, the picture is coming in fine, which is a nice blending of images. But again, back to the theology, there's an orality about baseball. It lends itself to description. The word is adequate to convey what's going on there. You really don't need the pictures. In some ways, the pictures compromise and handicap. And so sometimes, like theology, when you press for too much specificity, you only get fuzzier. You have to be able to have an active imagination to work with what's going on there. I think, you know, Walt's absolutely right. It was a game, if ever there was one, invented for the radio, invented for the real wordsmiths to work on.
Was it even true in the old days that the announcers would bring the game to life orally, even though they themselves weren't watching it? They were just giving signals.
They get the ticker tape thing, and then they'd recreate the game, a little crack of the bat.
Exactly.
It's a funny story about a guy that ticker tape cut about in the sixth inning or so. So he made up the rest.
Yeah.
This stuff was all published. Nobody can figure out what went on.
Well, I don't get the same. I just don't get the same thing when I'm listening to something like basketball or football on the radio.
I was going to make a further comment. One of the things that I like about baseball is that, among other things, that it stresses the achievements of the individual, and you have to be good as an individual. It is a team effort, but you have to be good as an individual, and everyone counts. But in addition to that, it's theoretically non-contact. I mean, flying spikes and everything else, but theoretically, it is non-contact. You made a comment too about how interesting it is that the defensive team has the ball.
Yeah.
The offensive team is never touching the ball.
Unique among sports in that regard.
Yeah.
Got a comment back here, Tim, or somebody?
Yeah, on the piece about the oralness of baseball, we go to the Sonics. We live in Seattle and share season's tickets, so we go to Sonics and it's high, as you know, high action, and we have little communality as we watch the Sonics. Basically, we go there, we sit in two seats and watch the game. Maybe comment every once in a while, but it's so fast-paced. Same thing with football, but one reason we've gone to baseball games, we were just in Wisconsin, went to the Brewers. One reason we go to games is...
Now that takes some devotion.
this was a concession for some relatives. But we loved the communality.
Yeah.
The communion of baseball, the conversation. So it's the oralness of the announcer is one thing, but the conversation and the community that takes place in baseball, I think, is distinguishes that amongst a lot of sports.
And that's why I think it's like liturgy in a sense. It's not as staged as football or basketball, which is more like theater. You go and you watch, you interact with the actors doing their thing. You don't talk that much. But liturgy that is natural and has some space in it to think about what's going on and to experience community, that's much more like the involvement you have in the baseball game. I don't know, you have more?
That's the community piece of baseball is more important for me than anything else in terms of spectatorness. It actually gets me into the game more. I'm actually doing the liturgy, the work of the people.
Yes.
I'm not just a participant, an observer, but I'm a participant in the conversation of that community.
Yeah.
So it really is literally the work of the people, whereas in these other sports, I'm out of it. I'm really out of it, even though it's more fast-paced in some sense.
Yeah. There's a kind of communion of saints going on. I remember thinking somewhere when I was about in junior high school, I was at a baseball game at Cleveland Stadium with a junior high friend of mine. We were talking, as I don't know why we just used to do a lot, talk about Babe Ruth. And I thought, I wonder if there's ever been a Major League Baseball game played where someone somewhere in the stands didn't mention Babe Ruth's name. I doubt it. I just doubt it. And you know, so there's a kind of remembrance of the, you know, some play evokes the memory of some other player, and past and present kind of come together in a wonderful way.
Yeah.
That, well, with basketball, happens too fast. You can't, you know, you just don't think of all those things. Whoever's next, Michael.
Communion of Saints reminds me that baseball is really the only sport left, professional sport in America left, where it's not given over to the beautiful people. The so-called beautiful people. We're all beautiful and watching a baseball game. Not concerned about whether Jack Nicholson is sitting in the front row or is Spike Lee having it out with one of the players on the court. You know, nonsense like that.
Yeah.
Baseball, you go, everybody's on an equal level. You're in, once again, you're in conversation. You're engaged, not only with the game, but you're engaged with other people.
Yeah. And one of the engaging things is, baseball, I think this is George Will's point, baseball offers you the illusion that you could do that too. I mean, I could go stand and play left field and catch that fly ball.
Yeah.
My friend Bruce and I, who go to watch baseball, we often say to each other, somebody makes a bonehead play, and I say, we could have done that. And it's true. I mean, we both played some baseball, and we could have done that. The difference is, Bruce or I could do that one time out of 100. To play big league ball, you got to do it 99 times out of 100. But it offers you the illusion that you two could do it. You know, I know I can't slam dunk a basketball, you know, and I know I could not block some 350-pound lineman. It's just... These are gods beyond me, you know. But base people my size can and smaller can play baseball. So although you know I'm not nearly that talented, but the illusion is there that it's possible.